Today, I have got an awesome podcast for you here on Backcountry Rookies. So today is pronghorn antelope hunting with Randy Newberg. So this is an outdoor class-based podcast. Randy recently did an entire series on outdoor class that is dedicated to pronghorn antelope hunting, and it's phenomenal. There's an absolute just ton of information that's in there. Today we go through some of that. If you want to get all of the pronghorn hunting information, then you need to be an outdoor class subscriber. Use the code ROOKIES when you sign up and you save $20. So that membership is usually $100, and that includes all of the courses that are on the outdoor class platform. $100, use the code ROOKIES and you get it for $80. Anyway, let's hop into this show with Randy. Before we jump into the show, don't forget to check out my new podcast. It's called Out of State Hunter, and it is solely based on rules and regulations and helping non-residents understand the different states that are out there, understand the regulations, and how you can take advantage of the opportunities that are out there as a non-resident. It's called Out of State Hunter. Super cool podcast. I think I've got about 15 or 20 episodes up already. I've done many episodes where I sit down with all of the state agencies and we talk through the regulation book. We talk through application process. We talk through all that stuff. So check that out, Out of State Hunter podcast. And let's jump into this show with Randy Newberg. Welcome back to the Backcountry Rookies podcast. So today I have Randy Newberg on here, and we are going to talk about one of my favorite animals in Western hunting, I think. I think Randy kind of likes them too, but we're going to talk about pronghorn. And more importantly, we're going to talk about Randy's recent series that he has that released on outdoor class. I just got through going through it. I think it's very newly released. Was it released last week, Randy?
It went out actually on Monday, so it's 5 days old, Chad.
5 days old, probably maybe a week at the most by the time this thing releases. So anyway, Randy and the crew at Outdoor Class put together a very, very good series on their channel. Today we're going to hit some of the highlights, and we're not going to go through all of these things. We're not going to talk about every part of it because we've got to save some high quality info for the subscribers, but but we are going to hit some of the high points, and I think this is going to be a great show. So luckily, I know it's going to be great because I have a pretty unique opportunity this year. I have a landowner tag here in New Mexico to hunt pronghorn. Ooh. So yeah, I'm pretty excited. So any pointers I can pick up today, I'm going to absorb them like a sponge for sure.
Are you doing archery or rifle?
Rifle.
Okay.
I don't know if I want to chase them things with a bow.
Oh, it's so much fun, but it's so hard. It's like everything, you know, with a bow, you're asking for some frustrations.
Yeah.
But you're also going to get a lot of opportunities to go do it. So in the course, you'll see how we dedicate a whole chapter to archery pronghorn. So
yeah. And that's one of the topics we're going to talk about today is the archery tactics. So we're going to hit a few of these. The first thing that I really wanted to do was have Randy talk a little bit about the history and just kind of pronghorn in general, where do they come from? Just a little bit of history on pronghorn. So if you want to hit that, and then we'll start kind of rolling into a little bit of the meat of the podcast.
Yeah. Well, I got to give full credit to a place or a resource. There's a book called Pronghorn Ecology. It's 600 and some pages, written by Jim Yocum and Bart O'Gara. And I call it the Pronghorn Bible. And anyone I know who's a student of pronghorn or a biologist in the pronghorn world, they have that same textbook. And there's a whole lot of that textbook gets into this origin of pronghorn and the history of pronghorn. How did they become this uniquely North American species? And so they go into all this, you know, the Pleistocene and then what happened and how we started out with 12 pronghorns. Some were huge. I mean, some of these were like great big. Some of them had different horn arrangements, kind of like in Africa, right? People think our pronghorn is related to the African antelope. It's not. But in Africa, you have a lot of different antelope species. Well, we had 12 pronghorn species in North America at one time, but now we're down to one. And it's the North American pronghorn we see today. It's a somehow is this survivor, right? It made it through, and that book and in the course we talk about, how did they end up being these speed merchants? And well, in North America we had a cheetah at one time that's no longer here, and so these animals evolved trying to outrun that cheetah, and that's why they're as fast as they are, and they've never decided to put on the brakes, so to speak.
I think what do you say? They're 55 miles per hour is their top speed.
And some
Good.
people have said they've recorded them at 60, but they've evolved with certain adaptations where they have very light bone structure. They have, for their body size, 120-pound buck pronghorn has an outsized heart lung cardiovascular system compared to what a deer or an elk of proportionate size would have. And the reason that is one, they hit these top speeds, but probably even more impressive is that they can run for miles and miles at 30 miles an hour, 30, 35 miles an hour. Well, a coyote or a mountain lion or something else chasing them just does not have the stamina to run that fast for that long. So once they get out in front of a pack of coyotes, for them, it's just like, oh, da da da. It's they hit the cruise button, and the coyote's just like topped out, and he's not making up any ground. And so that's part of their evolution. Part of, every species evolves with senses that help them detect predators, and then also skills or adaptations that help them escape the predators. And that's kind of what you see with the vision of pronghorn being most say eight, like a human using 8-power binoculars. So that's their detection mechanism more than it is their ears or their nose. And then their escapement mechanism is their speed. And so we go into a lot of detail about those two basic factors of any species. How can humans understand that and then use that knowledge in their hunting strategies and their hunting tactics to hopefully overcome some of that? So they're a really cool animal.
They are really cool, and they're one of those animals that anytime I see them on the side of the road or something on, I just want to pull over, and I've got probably thousands of pictures of pronghorn that I don't know, they're just cool. They're coloring, everything about them is neat, so.
Their behaviors are unique. And I live here in Montana. If ever my wife and I drive somewhere, if we're going through Wyoming, she says, "Just let me drive. You're gonna wreck us because you're just looking at every pronghorn along the way." So I'm with you on that, Chad.
And
They're just unique.
very, very, very. And I think there's something else that you touch on in that course too. And you talk about the size difference of the pronghorn between the far North America, like the very southern part of Canada, Montana, and all of that, versus the size of a pronghorn in Texas and New Mexico and Arizona. I thought that was pretty cool too. Can you talk about that a little bit?
They've done just so many studies. If whenever you get into this stuff, you can take studies and just really geek out on it. But and this is common to other species, that the further south you go, the warmer the climate, the smaller the body size. The further north you go, the larger the body size because of the colder the climate. So as you go up higher in latitude and also higher in elevation, you end up with larger body sizes. And this gets really hard for me because I go to Arizona or say New Mexico. I've never hunted them in Texas, but your body sizes are a little bit smaller. A big buck will be 100 pounds, 105 pounds, whereas up here in Montana, Wyoming, high elevations of Nevada, even, you'll have 120-pound bucks. And you say, well, that's not that 20 pounds, that's not that much difference. Well, we're talking 20% larger bodies, and the heads are bigger. So if you're using the head as kind of your relative scale, it can really throw you for a loop. An 80-inch buck with a small head like you'd see in West Texas or New Mexico is looks like this gargantuan pronghorn. And then you put it on this big horse-headed buck up in Wyoming, and it's like, oh yeah, that's a pretty nice one. They could be the same exact horn size, but the one in Wyoming is going to look smaller just because it's on a much bigger body.
Yeah,
And
interesting.
so I like hunting the northern bucks because I get 20 pounds more of body mass. I might get an extra 10 pounds more of meat.
Yeah, exactly. And we're going to talk about meat here in a little bit and how to take care of it and all of that stuff. That was one topic that I wanted to hit. It came up on Instagram quite a bit this morning. So let's kind of get into the meat of it. How do we hunt these things? You talk a lot in one of your chapters about the rut periods and behaviors and that kind of stuff. I'd like to talk about that because I think understanding both of those behaviors and rut periods is essential to kind of understanding your hunt plan and putting together a hunt plan for the critter.
Yeah, and so for pronghorn, there's really three primary calendar periods that we hunt them in. If you've saw this, sat through my elk seminars or my elk course, I talk about five periods. But with pronghorn, we can kind of break it down to three periods. We've got the pre-rut, peak rut, and post-rut. And that sounds pretty simple, but the pronghorn bucks are doing something different, distinctly different in each of those three periods. And that's why I always look at, all right, what period am I in and what is the behavior of bucks in that period? And then what's influencing that behavior? So if we go into the pre-rut period, you're going to see a lot of the younger bucks, the 1, 2, and 3 year old bucks are in bachelor groups. I mean, you'll be driving down the road and you're like, well, look at that. There's 12 bucks altogether. Well, those are usually the subordinate bucks, by body size and by age. Now, we know that pronghorn can peak at 3 or 4 years. So you might see a great big buck in that group of subordinate bucks, like horns where you hit the brakes, like, I got to go chase that guy. But this pre-rut period, you're going to have the older bucks are going to be kind of loners, but they're all still sort of establishing their territories for the upcoming rut, right? They're kind of walking around, doing some scrapes, maybe just checking things out. They're very habitual at this time. And the super old, dominant bucks that are bigger in body size and have been through the battles, they're going to be by themselves doing their own thing. Then that runs pretty much the whole month of August. Get towards the end of August, early September. Now we hit the peak rut. And this is where the bachelor groups of younger subordinate bucks disperse. The bigger, older, dominant buck starts rounding up his does, and he's trying to keep them within his territory. He doesn't want them going over to the neighbor's place. I mean, you think about it, it's like not too much different than humans, right? We're always posturing and doing whatever we can to keep ourselves in company. So the peak rut period is the fun period. They're going bonkers. They're chasing each other. You'll see bucks fighting. You'll see them chasing each other across the prairie, dust clouds flying. And it really is a very competitive period. Now, these older bucks run themselves ragged. I mean, for this 5 or 6 week period of the peak rut, it starts. The peak part runs from early September to early October, and by about October 8th or 10th, it's pretty much wound down. But at that point, most of those periods are rifle hunts, and just their activity level makes them easier to find. They're pretty conspicuous out there doing what they do, and you can take advantage of this very aggressive behavior they have, whether you're hunting a dominant buck or a subordinate buck. And we get into the different ways you'd hunt the subordinate buck versus the dominant buck, and then from there you transition to what I call the post-rut period. Everybody decides, hey, let's get back together and be friends again. The bucks jump in with these does. The does start forming their big herds of 40, 50, sometimes even 100 or 200. And they're all at this time focused on food. The Bucks have just run themselves to a frazzle. They got to get some energy back in their system before the snow comes or before the colder weather comes. So you'll see them in larger herds. You'll see them tolerating each other again. And if you want to find them, find the best food at that time of year on that landscape, and that's where you're going to find these big herds. And so we kind of walk through each of those and talk about, and as you saw, Chad, get into a lot of detail about how this behavior in this pre-rut period or this peak rut or post-rut period, here are the behaviors and here's how you take advantage of that as a
Yeah, there's so many rabbit holes I'd really like to go down there, but I'm not going to because,
hunter.
like I said, we got to save some for the subscribers. And you guys talk a lot about that vegetation that they like to eat on and the type of vegetation that you want to look for. So there is a ton more information in those there's two blocks or two chapters there, the rut periods and then the behaviors. That there's so much information packed into those two that it's I'll probably go back and watch them three or four times.
Yeah, you live in a unique area where you guys get a little bit different food cycle than what we get up north here, because you guys have an early season where maybe you've had some winter rains. And we know that, as we talk about there, pronghorn prefer forbs more than anything. But forbs are there with when there's moisture, and then they disappear off the landscape. And so your forbs start disappearing in April and May when the winter rains are kind of okay, it's starting to get hot in New Mexico. But then you guys get this crazy monsoon season in July and August. So you get this big transition again back to they don't like grass as their, if all things are equal, they're going to the forbs, then they're going to the shrubs like sage and rabbit brush and stuff. But then they will go to grasses until grass gets about 3 inches tall. Then they get away from it. So with your monsoon season in New Mexico, Arizona, Nevada, you guys end up with kind of like this double pulse of the repeat of the plant transition cycle. Whereas up north here, the pulse or the cycle is just one annual cycle.
Yeah, you can it's fun to watch down here because you can see coming out of the winter, you can see, well, first we get fires, right, that are just burn up the whole state basically. And then you can kind of see everything is brown and you look around like nothing is going to live here. None of this is even edible, you know? And then that monsoon hits, and before you know it, like 3 or 4 days into the monsoon, everything is green and there's so much food out there and animals start to really appear. It is a really unique cycle out here. It's fun to be part of, fun to watch. Another big thing that you guys hit on is the tactics. And what I'd like to do, it's separated in the course into two chapters. You have an archery tactics and a rifle tactics, and I'd like to split them up here too and talk about some archery tactics and the best way to approach hunting pronghorn with a bow, and then we'll touch on rifle next.
Well, there's, I'd say for the most part, three archery tactics. Maybe some would say that ambush is a fourth. But the number one is sitting water, right? Sitting over a blind, taking advantage of their watering habits. The other is spot and stalk, and then the other is decoying. And they're all a ton of fun. For me, spot and stalk and decoying is I gravitate to that because I'm one of those, I don't know if you'd call it fortunate or unfortunate people, where I just have ants in my pants. I cannot sit in a tree stand. I cannot sit in a blind for more than about 15 minutes. And all of a sudden I'm peeking out the blind like, well, I wonder what's just over that ridge there. I wonder what, so, but I will say that every pronghorn I've ever taken with my bow, no, I shouldn't say everyone. One was spot and stalk. The rest of them were sitting in a blind. Why? Because it's just that effective, especially in a place or at a time of the year when water is scarce. And most of our archery seasons are in August, the hottest time of the year. Watering is a very critical component for pronghorn. You know, when we talk about how much water they need, we talk about what the peak watering times are during the day when there's a pulse and a spike in watering activity, what water sources they prefer versus ones they don't prefer, how cattle can complicate that, or how sheep can pretty much just destroy the presence of pronghorn. So those are the three tactics. We get into ideas of if we focus a lot on hunting over water with blinds just because it's so effective. But then we get into details about where do you set up your blind, how do you orient it, what water hole should you pick, which water hole is probably going to get the most watering activity, ways to force the pronghorn to have to come closer and present better shot angles. So yeah, we get into a bunch of stuff like that. And then when you get to spot and stalk, that's a ton of fun. For me, it's hard because it's not just me, it's me and a camera guy.
Yeah, I'm sure
there's
that's got
two
to
of
be
us out
tricky.
there.
Yeah, right.
And then you get into decoying. You know, the August, the decoying works okay. The later into August you get, the better it works because now it's getting closer to the rut. And very often when you're decoying, you're trying to get this buck to respond to a challenge or a threat to his territory or his does. So the closer you get to September, the better decoying works. And so in archery season, we kind of see a shift from sitting water in August to decoying and spot and stalk more as you get later into August and into September. So yeah, we get into that. It's a ton of fun doing it.
I got a couple of questions.
Sure.
So when you're talking about the blinds, what do you prefer as far as when to place a blind? And by that I mean, do you try to put one out a few days ahead of time so that first time they see it, they don't spook and just run and they have some time to acclimate to it? Or do you just throw it out and take a
That's
seat?
the preferred way, right? If you can. And then sometimes you get into almost this competition on public land of everybody's trying to place their blind on the preferred water hole. So you get into that a little bit. But we do talk about, if at all possible, set your blind up a few days early because the first time they're going to come in, they're going to be like, wait a second. I live here 365 days a year and I've never seen that fort looking thing sitting there before. What's up? But they'll come in real cautiously the first time, maybe the second time. And then once they get accustomed to it, they still are cautious. They still look at it, but they're a little bit more relaxed. So all things being equal, yeah, if the state law allows and you can set your blind out there earlier before season starts, all the better. If you can brush it in even with a little bit of sage or whatever the natural landscape allows, that's definitely helpful also to just break that stark outline of a real rigid, like I
Right.
say, a fort. You know, a blind kind of looks like a fort to what an animal is going to see. So there's some things that you'd prefer to do. I have set up blinds in the morning and had a buck come in by 10 o'clock. It's like, he must have been thirsty.
Well, they have to, right? They can't just turn away from it and walk away day after day. Eventually, they got to come in on that water. How about decoys? So I want to ask, what's your favorite decoy? And then I remember, gosh, this has been years ago when you had like this foam hat thing that you wore that had the antlers on it or the horns, pronghorns on it. So what's your favorite decoy to use? And do you still use the foam hat thing?
You know, I don't know if Be the Decoy, who makes the foam hats, I don't know if they're even still in business. I have a couple of them still in my shop. And I love them. I put like a chin strap on mine, like a motorcycle helmet. So that way I could shake it. Some of them you might see where I even had to glue or tape the horns on because I would be out there rubbing brush like a pronghorn does in the posturing period of the late pre-rut period, and I'd tear a horn off. But I really like that in that it's fun. They're curious. They start coming towards you like, hey, who's this guy? I've not seen this guy before. But I think people probably have more luck with a two-dimensional decoy that looks like a a immature buck, maybe a year and a half old buck. And the downside of those two-dimensional ones is if a buck starts skirting off to your left, you got to keep turning that decoy because if they get off to the side of you, all of a sudden they don't have that third dimension of depth and size. So There's some things you got to work with there. Pronghorn terrain is often very windy. You got to, you know, you're trying to stake this two-dimensional big, it's almost like a kite on a stake. So in the wind, it's hard. So it has some challenges with it, but over time, you kind of figure out what works best. But I will say that of those decoys, I prefer the when you are the three-dimensional thing. But a word of caution, I would never use a decoy of any type if there's a rifle or firearm season, a muzzleloader or other firearm season going on. Never do that. And
That could be a bad day.
a lot of people say, well, who would do that? You'd be surprised the times I've been out and I've seen two guys walking around with a pronghorn decoy. I'm like, oh my gosh. So, but I don't know that, you know, you've also seen us use the cow outline decoys. And we've used those. They don't trigger the fighting instinct or the protective instincts like a pronghorn outline does. But sometimes if you have cattle around these pronghorn, they just look at you and then they go back to feed, and then you gain another 15 yards. They look at you, they go back to feeding. I've gotten pretty close using those also, and that's, you know, a decoy in my mind is sort of a replica of a pronghorn. The cow is not really a decoy, but it kind of serves as a way to hide you as you're getting closer.
Another thing that you said, this is getting kind of off topic as far as tactics go, but I found it interesting. You'll never find pronghorn with sheep. And
Domestic
I
sheep.
did not know that. And I thought that that was pretty interesting.
Yeah, if you look at the forage overlaps between domestic cattle and pronghorn and compare that to domestic sheep and pronghorn, cattle are grazers, pronghorn are browsers. So cattle are mostly focused on grasses. Well, pronghorn, they don't really focus on grass once they get past about 3 inches tall. And a lot of times, cattle will graze away really tall grasses that allow forbs to come up, which is the pronghorn's most preferred source of forage. So you only have about a 20% overlap between cattle and pronghorn, and it's only at a short period of the year where there's much overlap. So they tolerate each other very well. Then you get to domestic sheep, and you have a 65 to 70% overlap in terms of competition for forage. And when sheep graze, they graze very intensively, and then they move along. And a pronghorn, it just comes along behind them. It's like, there's nothing here to eat. You know, they ate all the forbs, they ate all the shrubs, they ate everything I eat. And so there's a lot of displacement of pronghorn when you're talking domestic sheep. And then when you get to water sources, they've done the same studies to see how disrupted is a pronghorn's watering pattern when cattle are present compared to when sheep are present. There's a huge disruption to the watering preferences of pronghorn when domestic sheep are using the same water. And there's some when domestic cattle are using the same water, but not nearly what it is with domestic sheep. So when you think about it and understand, you know, the competition for forage or competition for resources, it makes sense that domestic sheep would be a huge disruption to pronghorn. But a lot of people really don't think about that. I do. If I see domestic sheep, it's like, I'm out of here, man.
Again, that I thought that that was really, really interesting because I had never even thought of it. So, it certainly lit a light bulb.
But the place where I see the most domestic sheep in pronghorn when I'm out pronghorn hunting is Nevada. Nevada has a lot of domestic sheep out on the range, and you'll see kind of like, you ever remember the Charlie Brown Snoopy cartoon? They had that little kid called Pigpen. He always had like this little cloud of dirt around him. You look out on the sage and you see like this little cloud of dirt. Oh, that's domestic sheep. I'm out of here. So.
Well, that's good. That's good. All right, well, let's get back on track and we'll move on to rifle tactics and some of the ways that you can hunt with a rifle.
Yeah, and we get into a lot of different rifle tactics, but they mostly come down to taking advantage of what that pronghorn buck is doing at that time of year you're hunting them. So in the pre-rut, like I said earlier, the older bucks are going to be mostly solo. The younger bucks, which especially in New Mexico, I've seen some really big 3-year-old bucks. This usually their third year is the last year they're going to hang out in one of these subordinate bachelor groups pre-rut. So most often, if you're looking for a big one, you're looking for this dominant buck who's kind of on his own, but he's very habitual. He's got his territory, he's establishing his territory. So you can take advantage of that. And probably the one thing I always say with a mature dominant pronghorn is if you've seen him in an area, come back and hunt that area. He's not far away. Their home ranges are not very big, you know, maybe a 2-mile radius in any direction. Well, if there's one I really want, say he's a funky looking dude, or he's, you know, size wise, he's what I want, I'm going to hunt that until I find him again. He's around there somewhere. He's just harder to see and harder to locate because in the pre-rut, he's by himself. You're probably going to keep, man, there's that same group of 6 bucks again. I keep seeing those. Well, yeah, a group of 6 is a lot easier to spot than that one that might just be bedded in some sage. So then we get into tactics that are very successful, very easy to use in the peak rut. And that's where we really get into the tactic you'd use for a dominant buck, and then the tactic you would use for a subordinate buck, because the subordinate bucks in the peak rut end up being like a satellite bull, you know, if you compare it to elk. He's not big enough yet to go and steal those does, but he might. So the biggest buck I've ever shot in Wyoming was a subordinate buck. He was trying to ease in on this dominant buck. And the dominant buck horn wise was not nearly what this guy was, but body size, he was a little bigger. And I think this buck I ended up shooting, I think he got his tail kicked a time or two by this boy. But he was easy to keep track of because he would just stay on the fringe of this herd that the dominant buck had controlled. And I just had to wait and wait and wait. And finally, about noon the first day, that dominant buck got tired of this subordinate buck. I wanted to shoot the subordinate buck because his horns were so big. He just got tired of it and he chased him off. Well, when he chased him off, they came on to BLM where I was sitting. Boom. And so we talk about that tactic for subordinate bucks. For dominant bucks, it's just, you know, it's pretty easy from the standpoint of you're going to see him. They're going to be there with all these groups of does. But then you have this problem of, all right, he's got 10 does. How do I trick that many eyes? And so we go into tactics that work there. We talk about using the periods of weakness that a pronghorn or a group of pronghorn has. Is we know that at low light, their 8 time, you know, 8x vision advantage over us is way less at low light in the morning and in the evening, and how you can use that to your advantage. We know that pronghorn, if they go in bed for the evening, unless they're bumped by a predator, the odds are they're not going to move hardly at all that night. So if you can't get to that buck that afternoon and you see where he beds, mark that and be there at daylight the next morning. Unless a, you know, a bobcat or a pack of coyotes or something have bothered him, he's going to be within a couple hundred yards of that spot in the morning. And that's another really good way to shoot them. And then we go into rifle tactics of when they're in the food patterns and in these big herds, what's their daily pattern when they're in the post rut? You know, they feed, they go in bed, they get up and feed a little bit, they go in bed. So they're very predictable and very easy to pattern in the post rut. The downside is they're in such big herds, you know, there's 60 of them. How do I sneak in when there's 60 of them? Well, we talk about how you kind of got to be patient. Sometimes a windy day is a good day because they're going to go bed on the lee side of a hill, and that put something between you and them, and you peek up over the hill and there they are down below you 150 yards. And so we get into a bunch of that stuff, and the rifle tactics I'd say are a lot easier than the archery tactics, just because you have the benefit of, all right, he's out there 300 yards, all right, I can do that. Now with my bow, you know, once he gets past about 25 yards, I'm starting to wonder, should I even take this shot? So,
Yeah, right.
we get into a lot of that, and it's somewhat dependent. It's mostly dependent upon what season you're hunting, the pre-rut, the peak rut, and the post-rut. But then it is a little bit dependent upon what the landscape is like. You know, if it's just pancake flat like it is in some areas of, say, eastern New Mexico, that's going to create some challenges versus if you're hunting some broken terrain of western New Mexico or Nevada or Wyoming or whatever. So, a little differences there, but I think the way that we presented it as here are the primary tactics in the three calendar periods, and here's the tactic for subordinate bucks versus dominant bucks. I think people get a lot of benefit out of that.
Yeah, that both that and the archery tactics are both great chapters in there, and I really encourage people to watch both of those. You also, so we'll touch just a little bit on equipment for rifle tactics. You already talked about not using shoot, decoys. What about cartridge selection and caliber selection?
Yeah, this is where I'm not a good salesperson, Chad. I usually, when people say, "Well, what should I take for pronghorn?" I just usually ask them, "Well, what do you shoot deer with?" "Oh, well, I got a 30-06." "Okay, use that then." And they're like, "Well, I kind of wanted to get a new rifle." "Well, don't let me get in the way of you buying a new firearm. Now that I know you want to buy a new one, yeah, let's see, kind of nerd out on this." But you know, when it comes to cartridges, anything from a 243, 6mm above is more than adequate. And I get into talking about, as a general rule, and some of this based on bullet selection and other stuff, but if your cartridge delivers 800 foot pounds of energy at the point of impact, you're fine. Pronghorn, you know, they're not known to be this super durable species like a big bull elk. So I don't really get too worked up about what cartridge people use. Be proficient with it. We talk about how I've only shot of the, I don't know, dozens and dozens of pronghorn I've taken with a rifle, I've only taken one over 400 yards. And we always hear about, "Oh, you better be ready to shoot 600 yards." Well, no. Most places you're pronghorn hunting, you're going to have shots that are under 300 yards if you have much in the way of stocking skills. So I get that some people, you know, they're going to take longer shots. I just don't feel that's necessary. So I don't get too worked up about that. I get into more of the stuff of, make sure you have some knee pads and make sure you have some good leather gloves, because that'll screw up your pronghorn hunt if you're stalking on your hands and knees and you run a cactus through your knee or your palm of your hand. I also talk about one of the pieces of equipment I use is I have a spotter and I have a digiscoping system with me for my cell phone. My cell phone serves as my GPS. I got all my waypoints. I take a ton of pictures through my spotting scope or video, inspecting every buck I see from every angle. And for me, it's not about just filling the tag, right? Most pronghorn hunts, if it was just about filling the tag, you'd have it done by 9 in the morning. So I try to get more out of it. I try to learn more about how they're using their landscape and try to have some learning moments while I'm out there. So I'm taking pictures and video of every buck I see. And then at the end of the day, I download them to my computer and I'm like, "Oh, no, yeah." And then say I had 2 days to scout. Now I have a pretty good feel for what's out there, and I can go back and say, "All right, this is the one that interests me the most. This is the one I'm going after." And I like to say, I pick my buck and that's the buck I hunt. And if I'm able to take that specific buck, it gives me a lot more fulfillment out of the hunt. And so people are probably wondering, "Well, why do you even throw a spotter and a camera in there as an equipment item?" Well, for me, the way I hunt pronghorn, it's a necessary part of equipment beyond my rifle and other stuff. You know, it's when we're elk hunting, we're talking about lightweight packs and we're talking about, you know, boots and all the kinds of other stuff. And yeah, they can play a role in a pronghorn hunt, but yeah, let's face it, you could leave work in the afternoon and go hunt pronghorn in your blue jeans and flannels.
Right,
And
from the truck with a spotting scope, you just set up a tripod on the side of the road and you look really, really far away, and you find there's bucks out there, right? So.
So we get into some of that stuff, but I think people will realize in pronghorn, I don't get too concerned about equipment. Whatever you use for deer hunting, yeah, you're gonna be more than adequate for what you're doing for pronghorn.
Yeah, absolutely. And you touch on it in that course too, where you say that their vitals are just massive. So you're it's not their heart is bigger, their lungs are enormous. So your ability to kill them is much easier when the target is a lot bigger too. So.
If you hit them somewhere in that front half of the body, you're probably going to hit a vital item.
And their bones are a lot lighter, so they're easier to break. If you hit a shoulder, you're likely going to bust through the shoulder and not get hung up. But
You're still going to get a double pass through, probably.
Okay, so one of this is huge, and we're going to start talking about meat care a little bit. And the reason why I think this is huge, one is you guys cover it very thoroughly in the course, but people always say either that meat does not taste good, or it was improperly cared for in the field, and that's why it tastes bad. And I mean, I disagree. I think antelope is delicious, and I think there is some to be said about the way you take care of it. But I'll let you take it from here and talk about your kind of how you take care of an antelope in the field.
Yeah, and we talk about that in there's a big chapter on this because for me, one of the reasons that I'm so passionate about hunting pronghorn is they're my favorite wild game to eat. And between bucks I've shot, does I've shot, pronghorn my son has shot, I've had over 50 pronghorn flow through my freezer over the years. I have never had one single piece of pronghorn that was anything beyond delicious. So I have to ask myself, am I just lucky? Or are these comments we get maybe have something to do with how the meat is cared for? And I often tell people if, say, you went out to some ranch pasture and said, hey, can I shoot that, nice little steer calf there? It's only 6 months old, but boy, it looks tender. And you shot it. And then you drug it across the pasture in the dirt and the dust, and then you threw it in the back of your truck and you went drove around town to talk to your buddies for 5 or 6 hours while the sun beats down on this. And then you hung it in your shop. Maybe you took the hide off, maybe you didn't. But even though it's hanging in the shop, the temperature is fluctuating from 40 degrees up to 65 degrees. You think that beautiful steer calf is going to taste very good? No. So, antelope pronghorn have an internal body temperature of 102 point, I think it's 102.3 degrees is their normal internal body temperature. You want to get that hide off as quick as possible. Complicated by the fact that we're usually hunting them in warmer months of the year, August, September, maybe even early October. So, the number one thing for me that I've noticed is some people just don't get that meat cooled off quick enough. I bring these full carcass synthetic bags that if I'm gonna do the traditional gutting on a pronghorn and take it back to camp, I'm gonna just drop it in this full carcass bag as quick as I get the hide off. And yeah, maybe I'll let it hang overnight to really cool off, but I'm taking care of that meat as soon as it's cooled down. And then I'm getting it in coolers. I'm keeping it cool the whole way home. I'm never letting that meat temperature stay warm or get warm. And to me, that's the biggest part. The other part is very often when we're taking care of this pronghorn, we're out in some place that's dusty and dirty. It's usually not some nice, lush green alfalfa pasture where we're at. So, keeping the meat clean is also another really important part of it. But the number one thing for me is getting it cooled off and getting it on ice or getting it in a meat locker or something where it's going to stay at a cold, controlled temperature until you can get it processed and in your freezer. So I really, I don't want to say I laugh, but when people tell me, oh, they call them stink goats for a reason, right? Oh, they stink when I cook them. In my head, I'm like, I must really be lucky because I've never
Well,
had
you've
a
been lucky
stinky
over 50 times, so I don't know if it's
goat.
luck, right? But I think they're very good. When I shot mine there on the wall, luckily I had a friend with me that was very knowledgeable, and he's shot several antelope in the past, and he knew exactly what to do. And we got out there on that thing. We took a few pictures really quick. That wasn't the primary focus when we got to that animal. We got a couple of good ones, and then we started getting that hide off of it and getting it cooled off and quartered out and into bags. And just like you said, back to the truck as fast as we could and straight into the coolers. And it stayed that way for a couple of days until I got home. So, and I haven't had a bad piece of meat off of that thing.
Well, I don't know if your audience gets to see the video part of this, but I'm looking at that pronghorn buck you have on the wall behind you there. Someone took remarkable care of that cape.
Oh yeah,
That
give
cape.
100% credit to my good hunting friend CJ. He did an excellent job on that thing. He's good.
And so when you walked up to that, obviously you weren't dragging it around because
No.
antelope hair, it's super brittle and it's super fragile. If you drag a pronghorn 5 feet, you have destroyed the cape. So we get into a bunch of that because pronghorn are remarkable. They're striking, they're beautiful looking animals, and a lot of people want a shoulder mount of them. Whatever you do, when you walk up to that pronghorn, if you have to move it to take pictures or move it to a cleaner spot to do the field dressing, pick it up and set it down. Don't drag it, because as quick as you drag it, you look at where you've drug it, and there's just nothing but a big litter of white hair laying there. And no taxidermist is going to want to have to work with that bad cape that you're going to bring them.
In fact, when I took this thing to the taxidermist, he said the exact same thing. I don't know who took the hide off of this thing, but they sure did a good job. And that taxidermist knows my buddy too. And I told him, and he said, "Oh yeah, I get it. That guy's never brought in a bad cape for me." So kudos to my friend CJ. He knows what's going on there.
So we spend some time talking about that because I think the whole hunting experience goes to the planning and the research and getting the tag and then planning the hunt, researching the hunt, some scouting, processing the meat. But a lot of people want to have this memory in the form of, we talk about shoulder mounts, we talk about European mounts. I want people to keep those parts and to do something else beyond the hunt. Because I got a whole room full of Euro mount pronghorn, and I just love looking at them. I'm like, oh yeah, I remember that one. I remember this. So we get into a lot of that.
That one hanging there, that's probably the only shoulder mount that I will do. I really love Euro mounts, but when I shot that, he was such a that cape is so beautiful on him that I said, nope, I'm getting that shoulder. The only other one was this Barbary sheep right here. I wish he had a really, really pretty beard and everything on him, and I was like, man, I really wish I would have done that one too, but that antelope or pronghorn
But
stays.
after a while, Chad, you run out of wall space.
I'm at about max right now, max capacity. I'm trying to convince my wife to let me put some stuff in the living room, and that's a tough topic, tough
No,
subject.
people wonder about that at my house. I don't have a single animal anywhere other than the Randy room. My wife is like, look, in your family, that's art. In my family, those are just dead animals. Get them out of here.
Yeah, well, this is the Chad room, I guess, because that's where they hang. But so I didn't have these in the notes, but I'm gonna blindside you with a couple of questions, and they just came through as we were talking, and they kind of hit me. If you were to pick a favorite recipe on, since we're talking about meat care, if you were to pick a favorite pronghorn recipe, what would you cook? If you were just pulling something out of the freezer and it's what you wanted.
The first thing I look for is that most people take their back straps and they cut them into individual steaks. I cut them into about 6 to 8 inch loin roasts, and they slow cook a lot better. So the flavor of pronghorn to me is so unique, almost a sweet taste to it. I don't overdo it much on spices or anything. I might put a little rub on there, and then I slow cook it on my Traeger, and I mean slow cook it. and I get that temperature to, I don't know, 130, 140 degrees. And by then my mouth is watering so bad. It's like, I can't take this anymore. And so sometimes people say, well, the inside is too raw for me. And I like mine somewhere less than medium, but not rare. So I'll be standing there at the grill and I'll just be cutting the end off as it gets just to the perfect liking. I'll cut another piece off. And so the end just kind of creeps away until all of a sudden I've got this entire loin roast sliced. And it's like, all right, time to go eat.
Yeah, man,
As
that
far
sounds
as
delicious.
recipe, for me, it's nothing elaborate. I really enjoy those natural flavors and I don't want to hide them or disguise them in any way.
Yeah, it sounds good to me. In fact, I think I may have one of those downstairs and I might try that. My wife asked me that just earlier or last night, I think, are you going to barbecue anything this weekend? It might be an antelope loin roast. We'll see.
Oh, yeah.
How
So,
about favorite antelope hunting story? Of all of those 50-ish antelope that you've killed, do you have a favorite story, one that comes to mind?
oh man, they're all favorites. I'm trying to think which one would be the most remarkable or the most fun. Probably the one that sticks out to me is I was in Eastern Montana opening weekend, and I'm on this big block management area, which in Montana we pay private landowners to allow public hunting. So this is about a 40,000 acre stretch where you get assigned these pastures. So I go out there, and far away in another pasture that's outside my assigned area, I see this really nice buck pushing these does. And I watch it, and now they're out of sight. So I take this little nap. There's this little washed out coulee, and it's getting warm. I'm like, I'm going to get out of the sun. So there's about a 2 foot depression in this little washout. And I start taking a nap. And far away where I saw those pronghorn disappear, I hear a bunch of shooting. So I sit up and I'm like, oh, someone shot at those. I bet you they got that buck. Dang it. And I go lay back down and I'm thinking to myself, I better check to see what's happening. So about 3 minutes, 4 minutes has passed now, and I look and I can see this line of antelope coming straight towards me, like they're gonna run me over. So I lay back down. I'm like, nah, that antelope never run in a straight line for 3 miles. This is, they're gonna turn pretty soon. No, I better sit up. So I sit up again. And so I probably look like this little gopher peeking out of a
A
hole.
prairie dog out there.
Yeah. And now they're only about a half mile away and they are still coming on a straight line right towards me. I'm like, well, I better get ready just in case. This will never happen. So I get my bipod out. I got my 270 at that time. And I'm sitting there, and they're coming, and they're coming, and they're coming. And I pull up my binos and I look, and the big buck is still in the back. I'm like, they didn't shoot that buck. They missed him. Or something happened. Well, they keep coming. And finally, at about 30 yards, this lead doe sees me. They all hit the brakes. And the buck, you know how they usually stay 40, 50 yards further behind? Well, when all the does hit the brakes, he hits the brakes and he starts circling around out kind of more in front of me. They were coming from like my 2 o'clock angle. And he gets out there and he sees me and he turns broadside and he looks at me. Well, 90 yard shot. All I can see is just him. The scope is just filled with him. Boom, down he goes. And then the two guys who'd been hunting, they come around and they're like, we want to see that buck. We shot at him. We didn't get him. And if not for the fact that he damaged one horn, he would have netted over 80 inches. And so it's, I still, every time I drive by that place, I tell my crew or whoever's in the truck with me, I'm like, oh yeah, this one time out here, you aren't going to believe this. So I guess that was a reward of patience, and a whole lot of good luck. That one probably sticks with me the most, as far as bucks I've taken. And then there's always the one that got away, right? I drew an Arizona archery tag in 2011. I burned 16 points, and I hunted this really, really good unit. A friend of mine, Eli Grimmett, who owns Pronghorn Guide Service, he and I had been talking a lot before my hunt, and he and I have ended up on hunts in the same unit before. Well, I chased this one buck for all 14 days of the season, and I passed some really great opportunities on some really nice bucks. But if you saw this buck, you would know why. Well, the last night I chase him, I get to like 90 yards as they're working their way to this water hole, and I run out of light. I'm not going to take a 90-yard shot. I'm not that talented. So some guys who had, I bumped into them, they had the rifle tag that started the next day. They're like, "Did you get him? We saw you disappear." And no, I didn't even get a shot. And they're like, "Where'd he go?" I'm like, "You guys have the rifle tag tomorrow morning. I'd be down at that water hole before daylight because he's down there somewhere." And so I gave him my phone number. So I pack up, head to the interstate, leave the unit. By the time I get to the interstate the next morning, I get a text message from them and they'd shot him.
Wow.
And then they went and got it officially scored. It's entered in the record book at 90 and 0/8 inches
My God.
exactly.
That's a
And
monster.
I chased that buck for 14 days, and it was probably the funnest pronghorn hunt I've ever been on, and I never launched an arrow.
Wow.
So
That's cool.
it's
That's a huge
yeah.
buck.
Oh,
Huge
it
buck.
just mass and prongs. I mean, everything it takes to make a 90-inch buck. But
Yeah.
I know some people can make 90-yard shots. I'm just not that talented, and I just trust me, the temptation was there when he's feeding and he's got his head down and I'm 90 yards away, but he had some does with him and another smaller buck, and every time I'd try to get closer, they'd all look at me.
Yeah.
And oh wow. Somebody got him.
Somebody got him. Good for those guys, I guess. Too bad it wasn't you, though. Well, the
Yeah, it
way
would have been fun.
I think that we'll wrap up today's podcast is the way that you wrap up your outdoor class series, and that's with the top 10 pronghorn antelope hunting tips. You want to run through those top 10
Yeah.
tips, and then we'll start wrapping things up.
Oh, man, you're gonna make me go through all 10 of them, Chad.
Pick your top five. How about that?
I top five. Okay, first of all, don't leave the buck once you've found your buck. If you've found that buck that you want, whatever you do, make sure you stick with him because he's not very far away. He is somewhere around there, and don't leave him. Probably another one is, I touched on this earlier, is use the low light periods to lessen the vision advantage that pronghorn have on you during the full light period. In other words, early morning, late evening, they can't see as well, and you're going to be able to get a whole lot closer than what you can at other times of the day, and you're going to get by with a lot more during those periods. So do not miss out on those periods. Another one is use the sun to your advantage, and I don't care what time of day it is, when you're stalking or when you're sitting water, whatever, plan a stalking route or plan a route how the buck is going to come into the water so that they are looking at the sun. When you and I look to the north in the northern hemisphere, we can see way better than when we look to the south in the middle of the day because the sun is messing up our vision, right? Our pupils either dilate or they don't dilate because of this, varying degree of light. So use the sun to your advantage. That's another one of these opportunities to or situations where you can put that super great vision advantage to a lower advantage. Yeah, they still are going to be able to see way better than you, but by you putting the sun in their eyes, you're going to be at least in a little bit better situation. Another one would be if you blow a stalk or if you lose sight of the buck that you've been after, keep moving on them. Stay where you're at. Keep looking. Keep following. If you're on a great glassing knob, stay there. But if you're in a flat area, kind of just ease their general direction. And don't be afraid to stop and just sort of let things settle down, because pronghorn are notorious for making these big circles. Not because they like circles, and I'm not saying a perfect circle, but they will return to the place where you bump them pretty quickly. Partly because they're so territorial and they have territories, and they're so habitual at certain times of the year. So just because you bumped him, don't give up on him. The odds are he's probably coming back. And then know that all water sources aren't equal. A pronghorn, and we talk about this in the class, prefers a water source where, as they approach, they have 300 yards of horizontal visibility. So they're going to want to have lower vegetation so that they can see from wherever they're at to that water source. If there's a water source that has a little rise or knoll that they can walk to as they approach, and they'll just look everything over, because the number one activity where a pronghorn is predated is when they're watering. The coyotes, the bobcats, the mountain lions, everything else, they know that a pronghorn watering is a way more vulnerable animal. So they're on high alert, not just because of hunting pressure, but because of natural predation also. So pick what water sources is going to be most attractive based on the visibility that it provides the pronghorn when they're approaching. And like we talked about earlier, take into account that cattle disturbance will lower their preference for that water source somewhat, and domestic sheep will lower it almost to the point where they don't use it anymore.
Yep.
And then, for me, the number one thing is know what period you're hunting: pre-rut, peak rut, post-rut. And know that water and territorial marking are the two primary influences they have. In the peak rut, the primary influence is going to be breeding and chasing off competing bucks. And in the post rut, it's all about food. So know what those periods are and know the primary influences of pronghorn behavior, and you should be good to go. So I think I've covered more than five of them, but probably my last one is pick the buck that you want and make the most of your hunt. And it might be the body size, the coloration, like that double throat patch cape that you have behind you there. It might be his horn configuration of length or mass or prong or whatever. But pick the one that you want and go make that your hunt, and hunt for your reasons. It's pronghorn hunting can be so much fun. Don't hunt for someone else's purpose or someone else's reasons. Make it be what you want it to be, and you're going to have a ton of fun. So I think I covered 7 of the 10 there.
7 of the 10. That leaves three for people to have to go and subscribe to get the last three top 10 tips.
No,
But you, so I like
that's.
that you said don't leave the buck once you find the one. So when I shot this one here, the day before or 2 days before, I can't remember, I was out scouting a couple of days ahead of time, and I saw this really, really cool buck. I called him Captain Hook. Really tall, really big hooks on top. Nice prongs. One of his prongs was broken, and he just was a really cool looking buck, and I thought he was super neat, and I really, really wanted to shoot that buck. But we woke up that first morning, on opening morning, and he wasn't around. We couldn't find him in the spot where I had seen him. I think I had seen him the both days before, and he wasn't there. So we decided to go on and look around, which there was no shortage of bucks in the unit that I was in, but we decided to go and cruise on. And now, knowing what you're saying, is had we just found a nice little hilltop and sat there for the day, we probably would have picked up Captain Hook again and put him down. But either way, that one's bigger, so he's better.
Yeah. Was do you know if that buck that you shot there, that's a big buck. Do you know if that was a dominant buck or a subordinate buck? Was it in a group of other bucks, or was it by himself?
I'm saying he's a subordinate, and this is just after listening to you now and going through the course. He was in a group of does, and there was another buck in there, and the other buck was bigger. And this was in August 24, 25, 26,
Okay.
somewhere. So just before the rut. And there was a, well, so th there's an argument between me and my buddy CJ. He says this other buck was way bigger,
Okay.
it probably was not way bigger, but it was probably bigger, but it was kind of wonky. And this is just very classic and a pronghorn.
Right.
And that's the one I chose. But I don't think he was the dominant for, I don't think
Okay.
so.
Yeah,
And there was a
that
monster that was killed about a mile from where I killed this one that was about 80, I want to say he was like 83 or 84 inches.
Whoa.
So he could have been the dominant guy in that area. But
Yeah. Like I'm thinking about the biggest bucks that I've taken. The biggest buck I've taken in New Mexico was the dominant buck. He was with the herd, and others were kind of, oh, I don't know if I want to mess with him. Same with the biggest one I've taken in Nevada. The biggest one I've taken in Wyoming was definitely a subordinate. I got him teeth age. There's a place called Madison's Lab here in Bozeman, and I took him the lower incisors out there. He's only 3.5, and he nets 85 and two eighths. And it's like, whoa, I wonder what he
That's
would have been. Yeah, what would he have been if he was 6 years old? Well,
yeah.
come to find out, he might have been horn size smaller than that when he was 6 years old. And he looked way bigger because he wasn't that big of a body size. The bigger buck that was running him off, it looked like a 16-year-old with a 25-year-old. It just was. So I'm
I
always
think an
curious when
85-inch
people.
buck looks big no matter how what size his head is.
Yeah.
That's a big buck.
Yeah, I'm always curious, so I ask people that same question. Hey, was he with other bucks? Was he by himself? Was he, based on the time of year, was he controlling the herd of does, or was he getting run off? Because it's more about the behavior that tells you if they're a dominant or a subordinate, not so much the horn size.
Yeah.
So.
I'm pretty sure he was subordinate to them just by talking to you and going through the course. But either way, that was a
Yeah.
super cool hunt. And
Oh
that's one
yeah.
to remember.
I hope your hunt this year is just as much fun.
It will be, no doubt in my mind. There's a good crew. No,
Yeah.
it's a lot of it is just about the personalities that you're with. And to me, I like I guess I'm kind of a community type of hunter person where I like to be around good friends and kind of make it enjoyable. And I'm going with some really good guys this year, so it'll be a good one.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, but
Yeah. For me,
well,
hunting is very social, and pronghorn hunting is probably the most social of all the hunting I do.
yeah. Well, we'll see. Bear hunting, I think, is too. And this weekend I'll be out chasing bears, but or next week
Oh,
actually.
wow. Cool. Well,
Okay,
thanks for having
so
me, Chad.
you
Appreciate
bet.
it.
Where do people, well, I'm going to link all this stuff in outdoor class and the website and all of that stuff. And you can always use the code rookies. You save a couple bucks when you sign up. I totally, so outdoor class is becoming the resource for Western hunting. You guys are putting together so many great courses in there that every time I log in, there's a new course that releases, and I'm like, dang, man, there's another awesome one. So, very good stuff
Yeah.
coming out of outdoor class. And I encourage people to become a subscriber.
Yeah.
And they have to now to get all this great content.
Yeah, they get this pronghorn course. Remy Warren has done a mule deer course, and we know that Remy's got his second course coming out this summer. Corey Jacobson's University of Elk Hunting is there, and Corey's done a couple courses, and he's doing a couple more this summer. I've done rifle elk. We've got a cooking class by Hank Chaw, another one by Jamie Teigen. You said that you had John Barklow on in his backcountry mission planning. We've got, I think, two more cooking classes in the quote unquote in the can that are being edited. Mark Levisay's, he owns Tree Line Pursuits. He's got his e-scouting class coming. We're getting ready to film a bunch more. So it's,
Good.
yeah. And you get it all for the same subscription price. So
Yeah,
you go out there to
it's
outdoorclass.com and you get a feel for it. And every month we're trying to add more and more. And some to you've seen the production quality, right? The
Oh, it's
production quality is
fantastic.
off the
Yeah.
charts. So
I remember. So
sometimes
I
that
had,
takes.
go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Well, I had Jamie Teigen on, And she was talking about how the production quality was, and that she was just amazed with. She said people just started showing up, and there was cameras, and there was lights, and there's microphones, and she was like, "Man, I felt like I was on Food Network or something." It was incredible the amount of production that went into it, and I think it shows way beyond something that you find on YouTube, way beyond as far as quality goes and just production value and educational value of it too. So. Well done.
The premise behind outdoor class is to have true subject matter experts, people who've been there, done that. So, you know, who's gonna argue with Corey Jacobson about elk calling? Who's gonna argue with Remy Warren about mule deer hunting, or John Barklow about, you know, backcountry where things? So that's the whole spirit of it. The high production value. Sometimes it looks like it might take 6 to 8 weeks to get a new course out instead of 3 or 4 weeks like everyone would want. People are like, give me more, give me more. We're working on it.
Getting there.
So,
Be patient
but
because it's worth it. Well, good. I will put all that stuff in there. And like Randy said, he gave a rundown of the list of the courses that are already there. So, stay tuned to all the listeners, and don't forget, if you want to be an outdoor class subscriber, use rookies, and you save $20. So, can't beat that deal. Randy, thank you very
No.
much. Where does everybody find your all of your stuff if they're looking for you? They probably already know, but
Yeah.
in case they don't.
Well, we have a big YouTube channel, Fresh Tracks with Randy Newberg. Have a big forum, hunttalk.com. If you're into social media, we have the Fresh Tracks with Randy Newberg Instagram page and Facebook pages. And mostly you can just see me out in the woods, hopefully out in the hills. But I wish I had a better sales guy, Chad. I just I'm not really into the big promo stuff and selling gear, but maybe I need to get there. But those are the easiest places to reach me. Our YouTube channel is probably where most people are familiar with us.
And are you still on Amazon?
You know, Amazon switched all of their hunting titles to you got to either rent it or buy it. And so we're still there, but I don't promote it because I don't want people to have to pay from Amazon. Because we do have a sub our own subscription channel where you get everything for one price. It's called Fresh Tracks Plus. You go to freshtracks.tv. We have an app out on the in the two app stores. You can subscribe there. But the value proposition out on Fresh Tracks Plus is way better than it is at Amazon. So I don't talk about Amazon much anymore. You know, we used to be able to get it as part of your, it was free as a subscription to Prime back in the day, but they changed that. So I'm not going to do Amazon any promo work.
There you go. Fresh Tracks Plus, that's where it's at. So, well, Randy, thank you very much. I always appreciate your time, and thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you, Chad. Appreciate it. Have a great season.
Thanks, you too.